because we don't have a caller up on the board right now, how would you like to give just a little bit of a recap what you went over with me when we talked the other day about the stuff that the CFPB came out with? And
yeah, just
the effect.
Give me a moment to pull it up, and I'll be happy to do that.
Yeah,
it's really
I think
quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. And that's why, as long as we got a chance here, I think it'd be great to bring that out and have that information for people so that they understand that things are changing, and there's some good material, and they are really starting to put some pretty good restrictions on these people, which is about time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's you know, part of the reason that's happened is because of people like us that are you know, pushing this stuff and bringing litigation in the courts, because they track this stuff, they look at it, see what's going on.
That was the 10th, I believe, wasn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember the exact date. It wasn't very long ago. I'm thinking it was last Thursday or Friday.
Yeah, it was early. Let's see. I'm sorry. Didn't have it ready.
No, that's okay. It's I kind of caught you off guard there. I'd mentioned it before when the gentleman from Michigan was on with us.
Okay.
I thought it'd be good to get this on the archives.
July 10th, 2013, the Consumer Financial Protection Board tackles debt collection, issues bulletin for collectors, and form letters for consumers, and warning for banks. So what happened was, when they had this release of data, they actually released five different letters for consumers that consumers can use fighting a collection effort, you know, depending on the situation. One is a letter that requests more information. Another is a dispute and proof request. Another is a contract restriction letter. Another one tells them you hired a lawyer and, you know, talk to your lawyer, not them. And the last one is stop all contact with them. And we'll look at the letters first. But I think to give you an idea, the letter that this is not my debt, the way it reads, and it's really cool. Dear debt collector, I am responding to your contact about a collection of a debt. You contacted me by phone, mail, on date, and identified the debt as, and then any information they gave you. I do not have any responsibility for the debt you're trying to collect. If you have a good reason to believe that I am responsible for this debt, mail me the documents that you believe that make you believe that. Stop all other communication with me at this address and record that I dispute having an obligation for this debt. If you stop your collection of the debt and forward or return it to another company, please indicate to them that this debt is disputed. If you report it to any collection bureau, to any credit bureau, or have already done so, also report that the debt is disputed. Thank you for your cooperation. So they've really, you know, covered the gamut. This is probably the most powerful little letter the government's put out for consumers that I've seen. You know, you can send it. It's half a page. It's easy to type. You can download it from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's website and customize it right from there. It's amazing. It's amazing. For people that want to get the letter, they have to go to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's website. And again, I'm just trying to click through a couple things to get there. You can download it. It has complete instructions on what to do. And then in addition to this, they put out a couple of bulletins. And one of the bulletins deals with unfair and deceptive trade practices, which is something you hear us discuss sometimes on the website, but it's more of a state-by-state rule, which is different than the TCPA, the FDCPA, or the FCRA. But it does tie in together with that. The other one is representations regarding the effects of debt payment on credit reports and scores. And that's right out of the Dodd-Frank Act that was enacted. And it gives a pretty good explanation and cites not only 1692, but it also cites the Dodd-Frank Act line by line, exactly how the two tie in together, which I think is really important. And it also refers back to things like the American Express Centurion Consent Order that was signed by American Express Centurion Bank and FSB, the consent order, and American Express Travel Related Services signed it for their failures in collecting debts from consumers. They had to refund about $85 million to consumers for illegal credit card practices and also pay a big fine to the federal government. But let's go back to the Unfair and Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Under the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, all covered persons or service providers are legally required to refrain from committing unfair, deceptive, or abusive acts or practices, collectively known as UDAPs, in violation of the Act. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is issuing this bulletin to clarify the contours of that obligation in the context of collecting consumer debts. This bulletin describes certain acts and practices related to the collection of consumer debt that could, depending on the facts and circumstance, constitute UDAPs prohibited by the Dodd-Frank Act. Whether conduct like that described in this bulletin constitutes a UDAP may depend on additional facts and analysis. The examples described in this bulletin are not exhaustive of all potential UDAPs. The Bureau may closely review any covered person or service provider's consumer debt collection efforts for potential violations of the federal consumer financial laws. So they're looking at this pretty close, but it explains how it ties in. So for background, UDAP can cause significant financial injury to consumers, erode consumer confidence, and undermine fair competition in the financial marketplace. Original creditors and their covered persons and service providers under the Dodd-Frank Act involved in collecting debts related to any consumer financial product or service are subject to the prohibitions against UDAPs in the Dodd-Frank Act. Now, notice what it says there, involved in collecting debt related to any consumer financial product or service. Any. That's pretty wide. Uh-huh. In addition to the prohibition of UDAPs under the Dodd-Frank Act, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act also makes it illegal for the person defined as a debt collector from engaging in conduct, the natural consequence of which is to harass, oppress, or abuse any person in connection with the collection of a debt. That's right out of the law. That's what the FDCPA says. And to use any false, deceptive, or misleading representations or means in connection with the collection of any debt, or to use any unfair or unconscionable means to collect or attempt to collect any debt. The FDCPA generally applies to third-party collectors, such as collection agencies, debt purchasers, and attorneys who are regularly engaged in debt collection. All parties covered by the FDCPA must comply with the obligations they have under the FDCPA, in addition to any obligations to refrain from UDAPs in violation of the Dodd-Frank Act. Now, that ties it up pretty closely together. So it also has a footnote that says the FDCPA also covers, as debt collectors, a creditor who, in collecting its own debts, uses any name other than its own name, which would indicate that a third person is attempting to collect the debts. So I think we've heard of give me an example, Dave.
Well, the Capital One entities that are similar names, Discover entities that are similar names that do exactly that. Those are two real prime examples.
That's a little shell game. Or another one was American Express Centurion Bank collecting for American Express Travel Related Services.
Mm-hmm.
And American Express Centurion Bank isn't even a bank. if you look in your state register, you'll see that they're able to use the name. They get a waiver to use the name, but they're not able to, they've given up the right to practice banking. So that's a little deceptive that the state gave them a noose around their necks and they could just violate that really easily. Although the FDCPA's definition of a debt collector does not include some persons who collect consumer debts, all covered persons and service providers must refrain from committing UDAPs in violation of the Dodd-Frank Act. So even if a person is not considered a debt collector, they must refrain from committing UDAPs. That could be an original creditor. An original creditor could commit a UDAP. Okay, so the summary of applicable standards for UDAPs. One, unfair acts or practices. The Dodd-Frank Act prohibits conduct that constitutes an unfair act or practice. An act or practice is unfair when, one, it causes or is likely to cause substantial injury to consumers. Two, the injury is not reasonably avoidable by the consumer. And three, the injury is not outweighed by contravailing benefits to consumers or to competition. That's pretty simple. One, two, three. It causes or it's likely to cause substantial injury to consumers. The injury is not reasonably avoidable by the consumer. And the injury is not outweighed by, you know, a benefit to consumer or competition. And I can't really think of any benefit to having a collector collect on it.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. And the key words there that you ran through twice where they were injured or they may have been injured. I mean, I can't remember the specific words, but it's, in other words, we have these debt collectors sometimes say, well, you didn't have any actual damages. Well, okay, under this you don't have to have the actual.
Let's look at it a little closer. You were saying, number one, where it causes or is likely to cause substantial injury.
There you go.
Or likely to cause. Well, they define it a little better. A substantial injury typically takes the form of monetary harm, such as fees or costs paid by consumer because of the unfair act or practice. Now I want to all go off to the side on that for a moment. Anyone that's been sued in court, and there you have to check your state statutes, but generally I would assume if you've been sued in state court and they're going to do a breach of contract count against you and they didn't attach a copy of the contract to the complaint, well, you could get that dismissed for that. But if you didn't, and then they went on and tried to collect costs and fees, you'd have to have the original contract to show that it allowed fees and costs and penalties and attorney's fees in the event of default on the alleged debt.
And in the amount that they are trying to collect.
Exactly. And without that, then it comes pretty close to UDAP to me. Now, I'm not a judge and a jury. I'm sure a jury might look at it that way, but let's see what the Consumer Financial Protection Board says again. A substantial injury typically takes the form of monetary harm, such as fees and costs paid by consumers because of unfair act or practice. However, the injury does not have to be monetary. How about that? It doesn't have to be monetary. They've got a footnote. Dodd-Frank Act Statute 1031 and 1036 plus 12 U.S.C. 5531 and 5536. I mean, this is a well-cited document that you can download. Although the emotional impact and other subjective types of harm will not ordinarily amount to a substantial injury, in certain circumstances, emotional impacts may amount to or contribute to substantial injury. Again, that's straight from the Dodd-Frank Act. In addition, actual injury is not required. Again, in addition, actual injury is not required. A significant risk of concrete harm is sufficient. That's right out of the Consumer Financial Protection Board's exam manual at UDAP Standard 2. So you don't have to suffer actual harm, just a significant risk of concrete harm. And it reminds me of years ago, seeing on 60 Minutes of one of those shows, you know, weeping mothers because their college students who got caught up in credit card debt committed suicide. you know, some of these people are so cruel the way they collect, and young people are so vulnerable to that that they actually killed themselves. But an injury is not reasonably avoidable by consumers when an act or practice interferes with or hinders a consumer's ability to make informed decisions or to take action to avoid that injury. Okay? Interferes with or hinders a consumer's ability to make an informed decision. So if they're messing with your mind, if they're lying to you, if they're telling you that if you don't pay them, if you don't give your bank account information to them on the phone right now, they're going to strip your skin off, they're coming after you the wrong way, and that's a UDAP. Injury caused by transactions that occur without a consumer's knowledge or consent is not reasonably avoidable. So sometimes, what if they got a hold of your account and they decided to deduct more money than a person had agreed, if they just started to drain a bank account, which we've heard stories of.
Oh, yes. That's happened way
so
too many times.
Without a consumer's knowledge or consent is not reasonably avoidable. Injuries that can only be avoided by spending large amounts of money or other significant resources may also not be reasonably avoidable. So if you don't know what to do, if you're a least sophisticated consumer and you go to the attorney and they're like, well, yeah, I can deal with it for you. Just write me a check right now for $10,000 as a retainer and I'll take them on for you. We'll send a letter out today. Well, I mean, you can't spend the significant resources without it being reasonably avoidable. What are you going to do? And you relied on that attorney statement telling you that unless you can write a check, you're screwed. Well, finally, an act or practice is not unfair if the injury it causes or is likely to cause is outweighed by its consumer or competitive benefits. So I can't think again of any consumer benefit of being collected on. And unless, you know, they're holding up that, you know, Citibank needs the money or else, you know, the bank Nomura or something overseas is going to have a competitive advantage, you know, that doesn't stand up. But I guess they had to make it a little balanced or look that way for the bank. Established public policy may be considered with all other evidence to determine whether an act or practice is unfair, but may not serve as a primary basis for such determination. So public policy may be considered with all other evidence to determine, but it can't be the primary basis. And that comes right out of the Dodd-Frank Act, too. Okay, two, deceptive acts and practices. The Dodd-Frank Act also prohibits conduct that constitutes a deceptive act or practice. An act or practice is deceptive when, one, the act or practice misleads or is likely to mislead the consumer. Two, the consumer's interpretation is reasonable under the circumstances. And three, the misleading act or practice is material. Well, you know, think in terms of you get served with a complaint and you get 20 days to answer it. You never received a Dunning letter ahead of time or anything. There's an overshadowing there of your 30 days for requesting validation. And because it comes as in the form of a complaint, or if there was a demand from attorney that gave you 20 days or 15 days to respond, even though you're entitled to 30 days for validation, for getting a validation request in there, that would mislead or be likely to mislead. And a consumer's interpretation is reasonable under those circumstances. You know, that
is a least sophisticated consumer, right?
It would be a material practice that's misleading.
Uh-huh.
Determine whether an act or practice has actually misled or is likely to mislead a consumer, the totality of the circumstances is considered. Deceptive acts or practices can take the form of a representation or omission. Okay? Not what they said, but what they didn't say. What they didn't say. Well, what about a mini Miranda?
Absolutely.
That's deceptive. The Bureau also looks at implied representations, including any implication that the statements about the consumer's debt can be supported. Okay, how many times have you filed a lawsuit against the debt collector? and then their attorney tells you that, oh, well, you had a valid debt. You know, if it was in relation to FCRA claim, and they're telling, well, you had a valid debt. You know, they're trying to collect on the debt. We'll prove it. And the judge isn't going to hold that up there. But, you know, there's the value of when that attorney makes that statement, sending them a request for validation, because you can always sue the attorney that's defending the company on the FCRA complaint.
You're not going to create a problem for yourself by sending a validation demand to somebody.
They're better than a lotto ticket. Deceptive acts or practices can take the form of a representation or an omission. So think of the people that we've heard who say, well, you know, it's the original creditor, it's Citibank that's suing me. I mean, the lawyer says so, and I don't have any paperwork that says it's other, you know, well, but it was charged off, and it's been about a year or two, and Citibank still is holding the debt, and they're going to come after you. No, I don't think so. So a deceptive act, again, can be in the form of the defense. And that attorney, in a way, making those representations, even though you haven't tied it in with FDCPA yet, when they're defending, that attorney can step in a trap themselves. So now I'm talking two steps ahead at the moment, but just think of the implications of this stuff. The Bureau also looks at implied representations, including any implications that statements about the consumer's debt can be supported. Ensuring that claims are supported before they are made will minimize the risk of omitting material information and or making false statements that could mislead consumers. So when they send you a Dunning letter and you send a debt validation letter and they send back a few statements and stuff and threaten to file suit, and they go ahead and file suit against you, they're really screwed up, because unless they can suddenly come up with that paperwork, they've got nothing. They've made false statements that could mislead a consumer. It also could mislead a court. It could employ the court in the perpetration of a fraud. That's, you know, so UDAP in my state is $10,000 per violation. So it kind of amplifies and multiplies the FDCPA. To determine if the consumer's interpretation of the information was reasonable under the circumstances when representations target a specific audience, such as older Americans or financially distressed consumers, the communication may be considered from the perspective of a reasonable member of the target audience. Target audience, in that case, meaning an older American, or a financially distressed consumer, which could be a college kid that doesn't know anything, or not even a college kid, just, you know, an 18-year-old with a credit card that went wild. The communication may be considered from the perspective of a reasonable member of the target audience. So they're going to step into the shoes of the debtor or the alleged debtor in that situation, because as we know, the FDCPA isn't about the debt. It's about the debt collector's bad behavior in the attempt to collect on an alleged debt. So by them taking an unreasonable tact, they open up themselves more than FDCPA, but UDAP. A statement or information can be misleading even if not all consumers or not all consumers in the targeted group would be misled, so long as a significant minority would be misled. Now, let's look at this a second. A statement or information can be misleading even if not all consumers or not all consumers in the targeted group. So we're going to take it from all consumers down to, let's say, older Americans. So we're going to look at older Americans would be misleading so long as a significant minority. Well, a majority is 51%. So a minority would be 50% or less. A significant minority would be, I'd say, half of that. So say 25%. So as long as 25% of people in a targeted group would be misled, it's a violation. I mean, that hones it down an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise.
That's inclusive of a lot of people.
a lot of people. Likewise, if a representation conveys more than one meaning to a reasonable consumer, one of which is false, the speaker may still be liable for misleading interpretation. Okay, we've all, most of us have heard the French term of a double entendre, something that's said with two meanings. Or in George Orwell's book, they had double speak. I mean, even some of our presidents have been accused of double speak, and politicians of double speak, something that has one meaning to one group and one meaning to another. A loaded statement that in front of a judge, well, Your Honor, I only meant this, but they're going to interpret it from the point of the consumer shaking in his boots, one of which is false, the speaker may still be liable for the misleading interpretation. Material information is information that is likely to affect a consumer's choice of or conduct regarding the product or service. Information that is likely important to the consumer, to consumers, is material. So whatever information they provide is material. It's material to the decision a consumer makes or a consumer's conduct relating to the product or service that's in question. Okay. Sometimes a person may make a disclosure or other qualified statement that might prevent consumers from being misled by a representation or omission that, on its own, would be deceptive. Okay. A person may make a disclosure or other qualifying statement that might prevent consumers from being misled by a representation or omission that, on its own, would be deceptive. So that's a loaded statement. The Bureau looks at the following factors in assessing whether the disclosure or other qualifying statement is adequate to prevent the deception. Whether disclosure is prominent enough for a consumer to notice, whether the information is presented in a clear and easy to understand format, and the placement of the information and the proximity of the information to the other claims it qualifies. So let's think of a Dunning letter with the FDCPA disclosure. First Dunning letter with the FDCPA disclosure. Is the disclosure printed on the front page in the same font, in the same tone, you know, black instead of gray? Is it printed lightly on the reverse side of the Dunning letter with only a little notation that says refer to additional information on the back? Is it on a separate piece of paper behind the Dunning letter printed in grayscale instead of black? We know it has to be on a certain font size, but, you know, these are other things that they could do, and they're going to look closely at this. So abusive acts and practices. The Dodd-Frank Act also prohibits conduct that constitutes an abusive act or practice. An act or practice is abusive when it, one, materially interferes with the ability of the consumer to understand a term or condition of a consumer financial product or service. Materially interferes with your ability to understand a term. Two, takes unreasonable advantage of A, a consumer's lack of understanding of the material risks, costs, or conditions of the product or service. B, a consumer's inability to protect his or her interests in selecting or using a consumer financial product or service. Or C, a consumer's reasonable reliance on a covered person to act in his or her interests. A person to act on his or her interests, like a fiduciary.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, this goes into something like your mortgage broker, the person on the phone that is answering your questions about a credit card offer, insurance salesperson that may come around. What about the person that you talk to on the phone dealing with getting a mortgage refinance or a reduction or some type of mortgage relief from the government, or getting your loan reinstated when you're delinquent on it? Or what about a short sale? If you've entered into a short sale and they're misleading you, and they're actually double tracking you, running foreclosure at the same time with no intent to really do that, a consumer's reasonable reliance on a covered person to act in his or her interest. Okay. Your inability to protect your interest in selecting or using financial products or services, or your lack of understanding of the material risks, costs, or conditions of the products or services. It is important to note that although abusive acts or practices may also be unfair or deceptive, each of these prohibitions are separate and distinct, are governed by separate legal standards. Separate legal standards. That's right out of the Consumer Financial Protection Exam Manual, UDAP 9. Okay. Examples of unfair, deceptive, and or abusive acts and practices. Depending on the facts and circumstances, the following non-exhaustive list of examples of conduct related to the collection of consumer debt could constitute UDAPs. Accordingly, the Bureau will be watching these practices closely. Collection or assessing a debt and or any additional amounts in connection with the debt, including interest, fees, and charges, not expressly authorized by the agreement creating the debt or permitted by law. Okay, the Dunning letter. Where's the contract? They're telling you right there that if they're adding fees and charges and all this other stuff, that, you know, they can't do that. That can be a violation. And this cites the FTC versus Fairbanks Capital Corporation, Massachusetts, November 12, 2003, alleging that the charging of late fees and other associated charges was an unfair practice under Section 5 of the FTC Act and a violation of Statute 807 and 808 of the FDCPA. It's available on the FTC website. You can download the case. Failing to post payments timely or properly to credit a consumer's account with payments that the consumer submitted on time and then charging late fees to that consumer.
That's an age-old scam of that industry. Oh, boy.
And mortgages, too. Taking possession of property without the legal right to do so.
And that can relate to foreclosure or repossession.
Yes, it can. Revealing the consumer's debt without the consumer's consent to the consumer's employer or coworkers. Well, I think, you know, a voicemail at work might do that. Or a telephone call. If it shows up, you know, who's calling the person on the PBX board at the front desk? Okay. Falsely representing the character, amount, or legal status of the debt. Wait a second. That's basic FDCPA.
Yeah, that's
falsely
familiar, isn't it?
Falsely representing the character, amount, or legal status of the debt. So, in other words, an FDCPA violation is a UDAP violation. Misrepresenting that a debt collection communication is from an attorney. Well, misrepresentation, let's look at this a second. Some law firm, some attorneys, some debt collection practices masquerade as law firms. They may have 2, 5, 7, 10 attorneys on staff and 300 to 500 collectors in boiler rooms all over the place. And when that form letter is generated and comes out to you and it looks and it's on attorney letterhead, but you never talk to an attorney when the person called you, they're a debt collector. I mean, that's a misrepresentation that the debt collection communication is from an attorney, because if it's not signed by the attorney, but it's on an attorney letterhead, and, you know, it's a gray area there, and that's a misrepresentation. Misrepresenting that a communication is from a government source or that the source of the communication is affiliated with the government. I think that falls under electronic traffic lights now, that, you know, red light cams that hire debt collectors to collect, you know, that the government has outsourced the giving the ticket to a third party private company, and then they turn that over to a collector who's going to collect on you for that or for tax payments. you know, there's tax payments too. You're going to get a communication that you owe property taxes or some type of delinquent taxes. But it's not really the government misrepresenting that a communication is from a government source or that the source of the communication is affiliated with the government. Now, affiliated, we'd probably have to look. There's no definition there, but what does affiliated really mean? It's usually, you know, like an affiliated company business disclosure means there's an ownership interest between them. Does the IRS have an ownership? Is there an ownership interest with the government, or is it with the Treasury, or is it with the Federal Reserve? I don't know. That's outside of our scope here, but someone can run with that. Misrepresenting whether information about a payment or a non-payment would be furnished to a credit reporting agency. Hey, Dave, if you don't pay your debt right now, you dirtbag, I'm going to report this to all three bureaus.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Can't do it.
Do it, and do that, it. Please, please. I need the money.
And that was spelled out specifically in the American Express Centurion Bank Joint Consent Order 3 of October 1st, 2012, which you can download at consumerfinance.gov. American Express did it, and they had to pay huge fines. Misrepresenting to consumers that their debts would be waived or forgiven if they accepted a settlement offer when the company does not, in fact, forgive or waive the debt. Oh, that's a broad, you know, we're having a special Christmas sale now. If you pay your debt, we'll take 20% and we'll forgive you. You know, meanwhile, they'll turn around and sell it to another company. Or the mortgage company, you know, if you settle up with us or you do this, you know, then, you know, we won't send you a 1099. And they send you a 1099.
Do you think that's...
For people that were foreclosed on, they need to look at this pretty closely.
Oh, yeah. Do you think that's unfair and or deceptive practices, anybody? Think about the meaning of those words.
Yep. Misrepresenting to consumers that their debt would be waived or forgiven if they accepted a settlement offer when the company does not, in fact, forgive or waive the debt.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay, threatening any action that is not intended or the covered person or service provider does not have the authorization to pursue, including false threats of lawsuits, arrest, prosecution, or imprisonment for non-payment of a debt. Okay, we're going to, you know, most of them don't have fake courtrooms that they bring you into and all that stuff, you know, or fake prisons or fake arrests or whatever, but including false threats of a lawsuit, threatening any action that is not intended or the covered person or service provider does not have the authorization to pursue, including false threats of lawsuit.
There you go. If they don't have the permission to pursue it at that point in time, it's a violation.
Well, that connects right back up to what we read earlier, where they better have the paperwork, and if they don't have the paperwork, they're in violation. They are in violation. The government wants they want to make sure things are clear by having the paperwork before they attempt to collect a debt, and that's really the bottom line with the whole thing. Again, the obligation to avoid UDAP under the Dodd-Frank Act is in addition to any obligations that may arise under the FDCPA. In addition, original creditors and any other covered persons and service providers involved in collecting debt related to any consumer financial product or service are subject to the prohibitions under UDAPs in the Dodd-Frank Act. The CFPB will continue to review closely the practices of those engaged in the collection of consumer debts for prudential UDAPs, including the practices described above. The Bureau will use all appropriate tools to assess whether supervisory enforcement or other actions may be necessary. So that's pretty well comprehensive, and just a couple of little side notes. All debt collectors now have to register with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. There's something like the $10 million threshold. If they don't do $10 million a year in business that they used to not have to register, now they all have to register.
That's a big thing in itself right there.
Right. The CFPB put together this database where you can file an online complaint, you know, just simpler than signing up for Google. You can file an online complaint, and they enforce the collector to handle the other side of the complaint. If they haven't registered, they're in a boatload of trouble. They're going to have people coming into their office. If they are registered, they have to follow through on this to get them to, you know, to follow through on the complaint that you put in there, and it's monitored. They can't just ignore what's going on. The government is going to be watching that very closely.
This is incredibly substantial in what it covers and what it entails and in the detail of it. I mean, this is major stuff.
Well, and I'm not going to read the whole other one, but, you know, the other report has to do with stuff that you might have to beat a judge. You know, judges have been tougher on FCRA claims lately, but they've made clarification in relation to the FCRA claims now. Effects on credit report. One example of potentially deceptive claims concerning representations that debt owners and third-party debt collectors may make about obsolete debt, which can be defined for the purposes of this bulletin as a debt that the Fair Credit Reporting Act prohibits consumer reporting agencies from including on credit reports for most purposes due to the length of time that has passed since a consumer initially defaulted. That's reporting a debt past the statute of limitations. The FCRA imposes time limits, usually 7 years, on including information about debts in certain credit reports. A debt owner or a third-party debt collector representing that payments on obsolete debts will result in the removal of information about the debt from the consumer's credit report may well deceive consumers because such information would likely not have appeared on the credit report for most purposes, even if the debt had remained unpaid. Another example of a potential deceptive claim involves the representation that debt owners and third-party debt collectors may make about obsolete debts. Payments on debts in collection will change credit reports only if the debt owner or third-party debt collector furnishes information about the payment to the credit reporting agencies, and the agencies add the information to credit files and credit reports. If debt owners or third-party debt collectors do not furnish payment information to credit reporting agencies, then it may well be deceptive for them to make representations about how debt payments will be reflected on consumers' credit report. Okay, so a defaulted debt that you make a payment on, if they don't report that you made a payment, that's also a UDAP. Okay, we know instances of them re-aging debts by making a payment that a consumer didn't make. Well, that's a UDAP. But this is an instance of when, you know, there's people out there that, you know, for whatever reason, are making payments, but if the payment isn't accurately reflected on your credit report, that's a UDAP.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you were defaulted on your mortgage and then you straighten that out and they're still reporting you as being in foreclosure, that's a UDAP violation. And because it's UDAP and it ties in with FCRA, the actual damages would be the amount of your mortgage.
Now, see, this potentially opens a lot of doors for us.
And also they discuss the effects on credit scores. Another potentially deceptive claim involves representation that debt owners or third-party debt collectors may make about how paying debts in collection will improve credit scores. Even assuming the debt owners and third-party collectors report payments on debts in collection to consumer reporting agencies, in light of the numerous factors that influence an individual consumer's credit report, such payments may not improve the credit score of the consumer to whom the representation is being made. Consequently, debt owners or third-party collectors may well deceive consumers if they make representations that paying debts in collection will improve a consumer's credit score. That goes back to the Dunning letter that says, you know, we'll pay up and, you know, your life is going to be better. Because it's not, and they explain why. A third example of potentially deceptive claims involve representation that owner of the debt and third-party debt collectors may make about how paying debts in collection will improve creditworthiness or enhance the likelihood that a consumer will be substantially receive credit from a lender. Potential lenders may use a variety of sources of information to assess the creditworthiness of potential borrowers, including credit report or credit score information. Even where they use the same information, potential lenders may assign different weights to information in evaluating the creditworthiness of prospective borrowers. The nature and extent of the impact of the payment on a particular debt in collection to prospective borrower's creditworthiness may depend on all of the information potential lenders consider and how they weigh that information, factors that debt owners and third-party debt collectors often will not know. Debt owners or third-party debt collectors may well deceive consumers if they make representations about the nature or extent of improved creditworthiness that result from paying debts in collection. So they're telling you right there that everyone should know that just because you pay one trade line on your credit report, you know, Toyota is going to look at other things like your income and your car accidents that you've had and other things before they give you a loan for a car. They look at stuff outside of the credit report. So for the debt collector to say that it's going to improve the likelihood of you getting a loan, actual damages, again, you know, if attorneys were, when attorneys start looking at this stuff closely, actual damages could be the fact that, well, I went ahead and paid a alleged to, even though I didn't own it, even though I didn't owe $2,000 on a card that they alleged I had and they reported on me, I went ahead and paid it because I needed a $100,000 line of credit for something. And they told me that if I paid it, I'd have no problem getting it.
Yeah, well, and then I didn't get it.
Wouldn't they be liable for actual damages? I was going to buy a new kidney with my credit line.
Yeah, that sounds like major liability to me.
Yeah. So CFPB expectations. The examples of potential potentially deceptive claims concerning the effects of paying debts in collection on credit reports, credit scores, and creditworthiness set forth in this bulletin are illustrative and non-exhaustive. The prevalence of these types of potential deceptive claims is a matter of significant concern to the CFPB. Significant concern. Debt owners and third-party debt collectors should take steps to ensure that any claims that they make about the effects of paying debts in collection on consumer credit reports, credit scores, and creditworthiness are not deceptive. In the course of supervision activities or enforcement investigations, the CFPB may review communication materials, scripts, and training manuals and related documents to assess whether owners of debts and third-party collectors are making these types of claims and the factual basis for them. In addition, the CFPB will assess whether additional supervisory enforcement or other actions may be necessary to ensure that the debt collection market functions in a fair, transparent, and competitive manner. Fair
and transparent.
Well, wow. Transparent. I was just looking before where it says may review communication materials, scripts, and training manuals and related documentation. How many times do you do discovery and they say, well, it's attorney-client privileged. It's, you know, proprietary. It's not to the CFPB. They're going to walk in there and they're going to demand it. And you're going to have to – the debt collector is going to have to give it. And then they're going to have to argue privilege in court. But the regulatory agency is going to go in there and take it. They're going to go in there and get this information, or they're going to shut the businesses down. That was made clear. So as soon as you start having trouble with this stuff, you need to invoke the CFPB and what they've recently come up with. And I want to give a plug. There's a lady named Elizabeth Warren, who's now a senator, and she was the first director of the CFPB, and she was instrumental in getting it put together. And Capitol Hill and Wall Street was having a cow about her getting elected to be a senator. And then she was trying to become the head of the banking committee. And I forget, I think she got on it. I don't think she's the chair. But, you know, this is a lady who wants to clean this mess up.
She's a regular briar patch.
Mm-hmm.
No, she's a consumer advocate. She's
she's a Democrat, too. That's what's kind of interesting about some of it.
Yeah, really.
Well, I'm not even going to put any label on her other than she is a blessing. And we
absolutely
have people like that, you know, who see consumers. And you know, to be fair, businesses are consumers under the FDCPA. Most people don't know that because a business is also a person. But that's a whole nother story outside of the scope of what we're talking about. So really, you know, here's a senator. If you ever wanted to spend the 48 cents or whatever it is to send a note of thanks to Elizabeth Warren. And she's going to keep cracking the whip on these guys and moving them forward. And the guy that's in charge of the CFPB now is the former solicitor general and treasurer and a few other things from Ohio. So this, you know, a state that's had a hard time, and he's seen a lot of stuff going on, and he's continuing to drive the cart and came out with all this stuff. They had a big press conference up in Maine when they rolled it out, and the debt collection industry is shaking in its boots over it.
Yeah, well, Elizabeth Warren really is. I've seen some video of her questioning some other members of Congress, and she pulls no punches, which is great. It's very refreshing.
She's a regular Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah. Dave, I hope that was helpful.
Absolutely it was. And thank you very much. Actually, you were far more thorough than I was anticipating, but that's really good. I mean, you going through that as much as you did, I hope, was really a wake-up call to how much ammunition there is in UDAP now and with the CFPB behind it. You know, the Federal Trade Commission has been a joke. It appears that the CFPB is going to be a far better entity at really starting to lean on these industries, because the FTC has just given them a free pass for the most part. I think that's been rather obvious to most of us.
Yeah,
so this is real refreshing.
I would say they're exceeding my expectations when they were created.
Yeah, I didn't hold out a whole lot of hope. My thoughts were, one more bureaucratic bunch of BS.
Yeah, another place for money.
Yeah, just another agency to suck up tax dollars and, you know, basically do nothing. But I've been really quite surprised when this came out, and I was talking to John about it the other day. He called a quick run by and give me an overview of it, which I really, really appreciate, John, by the way, because you know I was so deeply involved in some other stuff here, I just hadn't had a chance to look at any of this.
What's with your eye trouble? I wanted you.
Well,
sometimes it's nice to have someone read to you.
Really.
Yeah. Who'd have thought my eye trouble? That's the ongoing saga. But and again, thank you for doing that last week. But then thank you for being so thorough here, because I hope everybody latched on to the idea that an awful lot of what John covered in there is virtually hand in hand, almost identical, even in language, to the FDCPA.
Yep.
It gives you another complete cause of action right along with the FDCPA.
What I left out was, here's the thing. If you go to consumerfinance.gov, That's consumerfinance.gov. That's the CFPB website. Or if you just pull up Google or Start Page or whichever one you use, I like Start Page, and you type in CFPB and then 2013-07, and then the other one would be CFPB 2013-08. Those are the two documents that just came out on July 10th. One is called the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and the Dodd-Frank Act, and the other one is Prohibition of Unfair, Deceptive, and Abusive Acts or Practices in the Collection of Consumer Debts. So you can get directly to these documents, but if you go to the CFPB website and just hunt around on it, you'll get a feel for it. It's so consumer-friendly. It's just wonderful, and it's right there for you. And what I was going to say is, as Dave was saying, where it dovetails, FDCPA and the Dodd-Frank Act and the UDAP right there, the whole document that I was going through has footnotes, and it gives you the exact citations that you need for those counts.
Oh, boy.
And
it's all right there.
And some case law that the Consumer Financial Protection Board has used to back up what they're saying. This is extremely powerful. The only other thing that I can think of that is more powerful is your annotated statutes. And just to touch on that a second, that's what is considered a secret document that you can get down at your courthouse, your federal courthouse, or your maybe they might have the federal ones in your state courthouse library, which is free that you can go to. Or if you have a law school, you want to look at the annotated statutes, because what they are, they're the stuff we go over all the time, like 15 USC 1692. You want to dig in there. The annotated statutes gives you the case citations from the highest courts, and we all know that, you know, all the other courts, you know, where we litigate are courts of inferior jurisdiction. The one court of jurisdiction is the Supreme Court of the United States. All other courts are inferior courts of jurisdiction. So their case citations and the annotated statutes are going to start with Supreme Court decisions, and then they're going to look at circuit decisions, and then they might look at district decisions. Now, also, because each state has a Supreme Court, because each state has a constitution, or at least it does today, which is another story, but the annotated state statutes will give the Supreme Court decisions relating to things like, let's say, vacating a void judgment, or standing up against a collection action, or a lot of other things. I mean, even if you're just helping your own lawyer because you were in an auto accident or something, there's going to be a Supreme Court decision for your state if you're litigating in state court under state law that's going to relate to this stuff. And you're going to find the highest decisions in the annotated statutes. It doesn't pop up in Google or anything like that, but this is, you know, this is what a judge is going to look at. This is what a judge is going to look at.
Yeah, and isn't it such a shame that it's hidden like that?
Well, that's because, you know, they like to use citations in the form of writing a report. You know, the lawyer, when he writes a motion for summary judgment or something like that, is writing a document in such a way, it's like doing your, you know, your research paper or your thesis for your class you're taking, and they use something like MLA formatting, you know, so it's all formatted up nicely, and they're loading in sentences from certain cases to back up the arguments that they're using. Many times we have found, and you can find too, just by taking the case citation they use, typing it into Google Scholar and giving it a read, you'll find that the words work perfectly. They work like magic for what they wanted to do, but the underlying case had nothing to do with what you know they're trying to use it for. They're misconstruing the citation, Well, your Supreme Court doesn't do that. They're very careful in their decisions. And that's after, you know, people have taken it through the district and through the circuit in appeal, and that it ends up there at the Supreme level, which means, you know, even the three panel or the five panel at the circuit, you know, we can't handle this. We really need the Supreme Court to make a determination on it. And they don't have to take everything that's thrown at them. The Supreme Court has to take it up, to study it, to come back with a decision. So what they've rendered there isn't a flippant response from a magistrate judge that doesn't like pro ses. The Supreme Court
does like
pro ses. I really, truly believe the Supreme Court does like pro ses. Because, and I don't say that to the extent that they give extra weight to a pro se. I think they are completely fair with the blinders on their eyes, like the scales of justice, standing there holding them. They, you know, they don't care whether you're a pro se or you're the most experienced attorney there is. They're going to treat the case fairly, and they're going to try the facts based on what's put forward and on their good judgment based on the, you know, the law that they're looking at, for the most part. For the most part. That's on smaller decisions, the stuff we're dealing with. But
yeah.
I have confidence in the system there. And so looking at this document, again, you can download it from consumerfinance.gov or type in CFPB 2013-7 or 2013-8. You can download the document. You can look on the site and then go look at your annotated statutes. That's what Richard Cornforth would tell you. Okay. Sorry to hijack
your
show.
What's that?
Sorry to hijack your show.
No. You did a fabulous job of what I asked you to do. You know, you just took it further than I was thinking, which is great. Like I said, it's good information. People can listen to that, and they can see the similarities. If you are familiar with FDCPA, when you listen to what John was saying there, you hear a lot of familiar words. This gives us another whole line of potential allegations for damages right alongside the FDCPA. And the UDAP ticket, you know, dollar-wise in violations, is more substantial than the FDCPA in most places. Because, you know, FDCPA is $1,000. That's it. You got some state situations under UDAP, you're talking $10,000. Some states, I believe we have that here in Texas, where you can triple it. So, you know, it's a whole different ballgame. So, you know, be aware of that. This is another area that we need to start delving into more and talking about more, because I think it's another great avenue to go after them. And the CFPB has opened the door for us and been very specific in giving the guidelines for it. So you can't ask any more than that. I'm really surprised at the fact that this came out and the information is as extensive as it is, and it's as detailed as it is. And really, quite frankly, as easy to understand as it is, you know, because sometimes things are so darn convoluted. But goodbye, FTC. Thank God for most of this stuff, and welcome to the CFPB. They're on a much better track already, and they've just gotten started. So, anyway, thank you again, John. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.